You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, December 10th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, President of the International Association of Flight Attendants, Sarah Nelson, and Chief of Advocacy at Raises Texas, Erica Andiola, will be joining us. Meanwhile, an FDA advisory committee meets on deciding on the approval of the Pfizer vaccine. This following a day of over 3,000 American deaths to coronavirus. House approves a one-week punt on the budget talks as stimulus and budget talks continue. Meanwhile, Biden transition cabinet selections are beginning to be seen as losing their coherence. 17 Republican state attorney generals join in the most foolish lawsuit ever against Georgia's election results. Meanwhile, Trump trying to muscle Republican lawmakers to vote for different electors. 48 U.S. attorney generals and the Department of Justice, however, have sued Facebook for antitrust violations and calls for divesting of their ownership of Instagram and WhatsApp. The Senate attempt to block the UAE arms sale fails. Trump's EPA finalizes a rule to allow more air pollution. Meanwhile, its Health and Human Services plants a ticking time bomb for Joe Biden. Minneapolis City Council has voted to cut 5% of its police budget and fund alternative services for the community. Hunter Biden investigation by feds was for more than just tax issues, apparently. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. We will get to it quick. We got a very busy day. Joining me, of course, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, Emma, there's a story that I was going to headline that, in fact, we will just discuss now. And we should start by playing this clip, which has been cited in a piece by Jane Mayer in the New Yorker magazine. This is Dianne Feinstein as the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, questioning Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter. This was back on November 17th.
On November 7th, President Trump tweeted, and I quote, "I won this election by a lot," end quote. Obviously, that's not true. Do you believe that label goes far enough to prevent the tweet's harms when the tweet is still visible and not accurate? Well, let me give you a specific. On November 7, President Trump tweeted this: "I won this election by a lot." Does that label do enough to prevent the tweet's harms when the tweet is still visible and is not accurate? On November 7, President Trump tweeted, and I quote, on November 7, President Trump tweeted this.
What it is, and at the time, I don't know how much attention it got. It got some attention in right-wing circles, apparently. But Dianne Feinstein, as the chair of the Judiciary Committee, was asking the exact same question back-to-back. And right. Apparently, this was the basis of this Jane Mayer story, where there, which talks about how Chuck Schumer had to approach her at that point and ask her to step down from the Judiciary Committee. And she had forgotten the conversation the first time around. They actually had to have it twice. And apparently, this has been an open secret Within, this is according to Jane Mayer's reporting, within the halls of the Senate for years, that there has been serious cognitive decline on behalf of Senator Feinstein. And, you know, let me just say this, like, I am very sensitive to this issue. I have had to personally deal with these issues. But there is a fundamentally different perspective here, or I should say implications here, when you have someone, you know, in your personal life or whatever, or even in, maybe in your institution, and it's a very sensitive issue. And how do you start to ask people to, like, maybe step back a little bit? But there are 100 senators who have an incredible amount of control to the destiny of tens, hundreds of millions of Americans. And we were very critical of Dianne Feinstein in the Amy Coney Barrett hearings. They were a disaster. Amy Coney Barrett came out of those hearings more popular than she went in. I may have undermined the Senate races in South Carolina. It's very difficult to tell, but the point is that this is a massive failure of leadership. She ran for re-election in 2018, and the California State Democratic Party did not endorse her.
Right. And I mean, I think Obama did endorse her, though, and the rest of the Senate was on board. And it is clear through Jane Mayer's piece, and she's a wonderful reporter, that these issues have been going on for multiple years in terms of the apparent cognitive decline. And of course, this is immensely sad, and you don't want to see anyone going through this, but Dianne Feinstein's 87 years old, and the tales told by Jane Mayer and recounted to her by these sources are just jarring, about how they tried to get her husband involved, how Chuck Schumer had to have multiple painful conversations with her that she'd later forget, and so he would have to do it over again. And they described it as Groundhog Day, where she was unable to recall those conversations and would be frustrated, lost in the details of the briefings that were provided to her by her staff. So Mayer wrote this piece very delicately, and I think that was the appropriate touch to address this kind of conversation. But the deeper topic is exactly what you're talking about, Sam, that leadership should have intervened faster if they were more interested in being
well, that's what leadership
potent,
is.
Right. And the fact that she was the head of this committee, this extremely important, visible committee for that long, that's a whole separate issue as well.
Now, look, there's obviously, these people are elected by the citizenry. There's only so much that someone like Chuck Schumer could have done, but I can come up with a couple of major ones. One, he could have said, we can't support your candidacy. We're going to support your primary challenger, or I should say not even a primary challenger. In California, they have what is known as a jungle primary. So she was actually facing a Democrat in the general election. De Leon, who was the, I believe, the Speaker of the California Assembly.
Right.
But he could have also said at that time, we're going to take your chairmanship away, and from the Judiciary Committee. The idea that there was no exercise of leadership here is disturbing, not only in the context of Dianne Feinstein, but how are we as citizens, how are Democrats supposed to be confident in their leadership if they have already proven that you can get to this point where the only way that there's going to be some type of action, and maybe there won't be any, on this situation with Dianne Feinstein is for people to actually have to go. And I imagine there's a lot of people who there went on last resort to go and talk to a reporter to get this story out in the New Yorker, because leadership seems completely incapable of dealing or even attempting to deal with this problem. It's really disturbing. It's something that we're going to end up talking about more in the future, I have no doubt. But first, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to the president of the International Association of Flight Attendants, Sarah Nelson. Okay, I'd like to welcome back to the program the president of the International Association of Flight Attendants, Sarah Nelson. Sarah, welcome back.
Thank you, Sam. Very happy to be here.
So I've been really curious, and I really appreciate your coming. Obviously, there's been, coming from the airline industry, the implications of a coronavirus have been huge from an economic standpoint. I want to get to that, but I want to talk about a broader issue in terms of pressure on Joe Biden. And I am curious as to where labor has been in this transition process. I mean, we don't have a labor secretary yet, but there, labor is the many of these positions will affect union members, but will also affect the greater population. I'm curious as to what role labor has been playing, what role you think labor should be playing in this process.
Well, I think, we have been wholly focused on the crisis that's right in front of us. And so has Joe Biden. And so we're looking at unemployment numbers that are up again today. And half of my union is out of work right now. And we've got to get relief in place. There's this discussion about the bipartisan $908 billion emergency relief. That's only a 4-month funding bill that'll get us to a place where Joe Biden can talk about his coronavirus relief plan. And I think that there is a lot of room within that to do a lot of work on labor issues. This is a tremendous platform, actually, for Joe Biden to talk about the essential work of workers, why workers need the right to organize and bargain in their workplace and have the ability to speak up and use whistleblower protections that, frankly, are not real protections unless you have a union to back you up with those legal rights. So Joe Biden's labor platform goes really hand in hand with his platform to combat coronavirus. And we've got to have the relief package in place so that people have enough strength to fight for it. So, that is my focus. And I understand that a lot of people are focused on the transition and who's going to be appointed to what position. I think that what we've seen is that we've seen a little bit of a fractured labor movement talking about this. It's very difficult for the president-elect to respond when he's getting a lot of different advice from a lot of different unions. So we've got to be a little bit more focused about what our demands are and what we're asking for. But whoever Joe Biden is appointing, and let's make sure it's not union busters like Rahm Emanuel. We've been very clear right about that. But whoever Joe Biden is appointing and whatever happens in the Georgia elections, the only way that we're going to move any kind of agenda that works for working people is if the labor movement is growing, is strategically focused on what our demands are, and is pulling together in a way that we understand each other, we understand what everyone brings to the table on that, how people are going to be affected, and we're building a majority support for demanding that the agenda that we put forward is one that Joe Biden and Congress has to respond to.
All right. So, and I want to touch on the relief package, because that just seems like a complete mess right now, frankly. I imagine, too, the implications of Georgia are sort of like almost freezing everybody in some way. Just staying on the transition for a moment, and I appreciate that your union may not be necessarily focused on that, but broadly speaking as a movement, like how do you get to that type of cohesion where labor can be a force in pushing what's happening in terms of the transition? Because, my sense is that so much of the tired metaphor I'm using is sort of like, you're putting down this train track. And so there's only, so much room for where you can deviate once you lay down that track. And some of that track is sort of like being built right now, as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
So sure. Give me a sense of how that happens or how could it happen?
So I think, take pensions, for example. There's a huge pension crisis going on in this country that people are not really talking about because we've got so many other distractions going on. But before coronavirus was hitting, this was a big topic. This was a big political topic. And there's a lot of different ways that people want to address this issue. And unions are not necessarily on the same page together. And so we've got to have a labor movement that is getting everyone in the room. Where we do what we're supposed to be doing in the House of Labor, which is, you know, fighting that out, understanding where everyone's coming from and getting on the same page. Because the power of labor is really the people in the unions, right? You can, if we want to think about this in terms of business unionism, where we just have relationships with people and we think that somehow these relationships are going to get us somewhere in capitalism, we've lost before we started. So we got to go back to the basics and get everyone in the room together, understand. The thing about coronavirus is that we've got a shared experience right now,
right,
that should give us a common theme to get in a room together and talk about this and understand that, you know, workers are not defined by the way that the corporate elite would like to define us as being, either, you know, white workers who come from older unions or new workers to the labor movement, like domestic workers. We're all workers. And actually, the economy doesn't work if you don't have childcare for people to be able to go to work, for example. And the economy doesn't work if you don't have truck drivers delivering goods to our communities. So there's a common thread here. And I'll tell you, when I was standing on the GM picket line a year ago, and I was listening to those GM auto strikers and hearing their demands in their contract bargaining, I may as well have been in a flight attendant union meeting. The right. demands were exactly the same. The corporation had defined the workers in two different tiers, doing the same exact work, but getting different pay and benefits and having different rights on the job. The same thing happens in the airline industry. You can take this across any industry that you want to look at. So if we can get labor into the same room and understand that we don't actually have a fractured labor movement, we actually have common demands. And we need to understand what those are, and we need to be speaking with one voice. And that's where I think that we can do a better job of making this very clear, because when we've got a whole bunch of different unions going at Democrats and saying, we all have these demands and we expect you to respond to us because you're Democrats, that's not really going to get us anywhere. And it's also not going to bring all of our union members along who don't necessarily see themselves as Democrats. So we have to be thinking of ourselves as a labor movement, not an arm of the Democratic Party, but as a labor movement with demands for working people. We've got to have working people understand how we've got these connected issues together. And that's how we're going to move an agenda forward. And the one thing I'll say about this with Joe Biden is that his rhetoric around labor is better than we've heard from a president in 100 years. Mm. So we actually have, as you say, some good train tracks here being laid. If we want to actually move the choo-choo train down the tracks, what we have to do is just to get together and be very clear about those demands. And when we're clear about those demands, you put whoever is in office on the spot and you're calling the question very clearly about, do you support us or not? And I'll tell you, that's what we've done in aviation labor. And that's why the relief that we got in March and that we're fighting to get back now and extend now looks so different than every other industry, because we were very clear together. We're 80% organized, and we were very clear that the relief this time was not going to be a giveaway to corporations where they can decide how to use it and give bonuses to executives. It was going to be workers first. It was going to be focused on paying workers pay and benefits, keeping us in our jobs, and then also capping executive compensation during this time of crisis and banning stock buybacks and dividends and making sure that this is a jobs and infrastructure program so that we can continue to serve all the communities and fight the virus and continue to do what we say we are, essential workers providing an essential service and able to lift the economy again. So we got that because we had clear demands together and right. because we had enough political power to be able to get that done, because we were able to hold both Democrats and Republicans accountable to that.
I want to swing back to something you said about managerial unionism in a moment, but since yeah. we're at the question of aviation demands, and we'll talk about, you know, in your industry, Mm-hmm. One of the things, and I really continually credit your union for the end of the government shutdown a couple of years ago, because and this is, I think, and I'm curious if you think this is part of the leverage. The fact is that lawmakers, wealthy people, business, particularly in an era, you know, when you have, you know, in a non-pandemic environment, rely on air travel more so, obviously, than sort of your average person does for their daily business, their weekly business. So you have added, do you think that that added leverage helps, that the idea that the leverage may be more clear helps in the organizing that you folks do in that industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have a tremendous advantage in the fact that the average person in America can relate to air travel, can relate to transportation, and at least on some level what it means in their lives. And it also is very important to a lot of people who have money and control. And during the government shutdown, I got to really hand it to the air traffic controllers, NATCA, and all the work that they did to help the public understand what they do and that they have to retire at age 56 because their job is so stressful. And if they go to work and they do a 99.9% job, that means 50 planes go down a day. They have to do a 100% job. And so they were out there defining that for the public, and also taking the opportunity to say, you know, this isn't just about commercial flying. This isn't just about normal passenger jets that you think about. Oh, this is also general aviation, and the Super Bowl's in Atlanta, and all those corporate jets are not going to be able to take off and come to Atlanta for the Super Bowl either if we can't do our job. So yeah, I mean, we have, it's a real strategic industry. It's a strategic point of leverage, and we know that. And we also know that as flight attendants, we have more contact with the public than almost any other job. And so that's a real opportunity, but it's also a real responsibility. We know that we can set a tone for the country in the way that we put forward our demands and talk with people.
Is there an analogous, I'm going to get back to what you had mentioned about business unionism, or was sometimes referred to as managerial unionism, as opposed to a unionism that works not just for its own benefits, but for issues that may affect those people in their communities and broader social justice, economic justice issues. How does that happen? How does what the air traffic controllers you just cited did in terms of communicating to the American public what they do? How do unions communicate, particularly in this pandemic era? You mentioned childcare. That's been left out of, as far as I know, this round of relief. But how do you take this moment as labor and express to people that our issues that we are fighting for every day are your issues, and it comes into greater relief when, you know, the tide starts to go out in like a pandemic type of situation?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, we have to think of ourselves in labor as, you know, one big family. And I think we've got to do a better job of that. And business unionism is this idea that you elect people to be kind of figureheads and you have a service model. So people, you know, pay in their dues and they expect a return on that, as opposed to constantly mobilizing and engaging the members in the process and the issues and the power base that that creates. So we've got to do a better job of doing that. I will tell you that I have a philosophy of going into every room, speaking to anyone. It's not just because I say that it shouldn't just be about those relationships at the highest levels. That doesn't mean that those who are leading the union shouldn't be doing their part in getting into those rooms and having those conversations at the highest levels. But the only way you get into those rooms is if you can actually show the power that you bring. And as a union leader, that power comes from the members. So it wasn't until flight attendants were being recognized as being a part of standing up for 2 million jobs that were on the line during the government shutdown, and 400,000 people who were forced to come to work for free. And we were saying our workspace is becoming increasingly unsafe and we're not going to work flights if this continues. And so we expressed our power there. And that totally changed the rooms that we got into after that. So you've got to have both. You've got to have people who are willing to speak to everyone, to bring everyone together. But union leaders should be able to do that better than anyone else, because our organizations are not self-selecting organizations. The boss chooses who's in our unions. Right. And so they come from all different kinds of backgrounds, different genders. In our union, we made sure that men could have the same rights on the job as women. So you're welcome, guys. And so we all come together and we've got to constantly bring this very disparate group of people together and understand that we have more in common than anything that divides us. So let's get in a room, work through our issues and figure out what our common demands are. That has to be going on all the time at sort of the grassroots level and this mobilization idea within each of the unions. Because if we're not doing that, we're not having those conversations. We are going to remain where we are right now, a nation divided that's not speaking to each other, that's going to even different corners to figure out where you even get your information. You know, I looked at a poll yesterday that said 70% of non-union members are favorable of unions and want to join them. And 66% of those people would like to have better information and are looking for a good place for it. When we run real organizing and mobilization campaigns within our unions or organizing to form new unions, and we're talking to people all the time, oftentimes the polling in that process will show that the people who are engaged in those campaigns think of the union as their as the source that they will go to first for their information. So this is a place where we can actually have real information, have real conversations, bring people to a consensus, which means solving problems. And that's the kind of that's what's missing from our democracy, because as corporations have attacked unions, have made it harder and harder for people to join unions, have made it harder and harder for people to strike back to the air traffic controllers, Ronald Reagan firing all the air traffic controllers, which was a signal to the rest of corporate America to come down hard on strikes. And we've had fewer and fewer strikes over the years. So we had fewer and fewer results, more people leaving the labor movement, more consolidation and mergers to get rid of unions, bankruptcies to get rid of union benefits, our pension plans stripped away from us in bankruptcy, retiree health care, all of these things that unions built up over the years, and declining union membership because it's not inspirational to say, hey, come join our union. We're fighting hard to hang on to what we had yesterday, right, rather than what we're trying to get for tomorrow. So now that we've got these teacher strikes and we've got a resurgence of labor and people have been stretched so far that, you know, they can't handle a $400 emergency, most families in this country, people are looking for answers. They're looking for a different way out. And they're looking to inspirational moments like the GM strike, like the teacher strikes that have broken out across the country, the grocery workers, the gig workers who are standing up and demanding things immediately, the fast food workers and the flight attendants saying, you know, we're not going to participate in a screwed up political process. You're putting our lives on the line. We're going to strike, get 2 million people back to work and get you people to work together. So this is where the power is if we choose to use it.
Sarah Nelson, president of the International Association of Flight Attendants. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam. Take care.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to be talking to Erica Andiola. She is the chief of advocacy at Raices, Texas. We'll be back in just a moment. Do Joining me now, Erica Andiola. She is an immigration rights activist located in the Phoenix area. She is a chief advocacy officer for the organization Raices. Erica, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So there has been over the past, really, I guess, maybe week or so, a couple of very positive things. Let's start with those before we move on to what needs to happen. On the on December 2nd, the Trump administration agreed to hand over information regarding separated families, which hopefully will help expedite that process or make it possible in the first place. And on December 4th, a federal judge restored, essentially told the Trump administration, you need to basically turn on the works for the DACA program. Just give me a sense of your sense of these two events, and then we'll take it from there.
Yeah, I mean, it is definitely progress. And, you know, I think we're not going to be fully happy until we see families who are not just together, but also that we do as much as we can, you know, in the upcoming government to ensure that they are also, that they're safe, that if they made the journey to the United States to seek a better life and to be safe from whatever violence or anything else that was happening in their home country, that they are now, you know, in this country, with, you know, feeling not only safe, but that we go beyond that and repair the damage that was done to these families, right? And with the DACA ruling, it was such a relief. I am a DACA recipient too, and it's definitely a relief to know that we're going to be able to not only keep DACA, we're also going to be able to expand it to restore it, meaning that now people who were not able to qualify before, you know, a few months ago, now they can qualify. And we can also now request travel outside of the United States, which Trump took away. We were able to do that with under Obama. So it's a lot of progress. And we also have to figure out how we can expand that even more to provide more relief to other people in this country.
All right. Well, I want to address all those questions about DACA, but just heading back to the those families from whom we essentially kidnapped their children, as far as I'm concerned.
That's right.
Are you aware? Do you have a sense of the Biden administration's perspective on this in terms of some form of reparations? I mean, frankly, I would be surprised not to see these people have attorneys and sue the U.S. government for damages. Having two children myself, the idea of being separated from my children, whatever age they are, for that extended period of time. I mean, just the therapy, the counseling, the problems that I think would accrue from that. It seems to me are problems that would last years into the future.
That's correct. So there's several things happening. The only fix that we have heard from the Biden administration, hopefully there's more. The only thing that we have heard is that they want to create a task force. Maybe they're already creating the task force to be able to reunite the families who have not been able to be reunited. That's good. That's a great thing. However, we also need to make sure that it's taken into account a lot of the other harms that were done, right? So, for example, our attorneys at Raices do work with a lot of these children who were separated at and now are either still at shelters or who are not at the shelters, but they are with foster parents or with family, right? If they had family here in the United States who are not their parents, like uncles, aunts, you know, cousins. All of these children, not only are they traumatized, not only do they have all the trauma they carry from being separated from their parents, there's so much more than that. So, for example, even if you can imagine, there's a child here who has been here now for over a year and who's with their uncle or their aunt, or they're with a foster parent. And now there's sort of this sense of should they go back to their parents, right? So now you have to figure out, you know, going to family court. Do they have a family attorney, right? And there's just so much more. There's, of course, you know, a lot of damages that was done mentally. So we have to make sure that they have the right support there. But if they're not taken care of as a human being in every single aspect of what is needed for them to thrive in this country as children, and also their parents and their families to be able to be here and have a path to, you know, to residency and then citizenship at some point. We have to take all of that into account and not just stop at reuniting them. I think we did too much damage to just stop at reuniting them.
All right. So I couldn't agree more. And let's talk a little bit about DACA. What's your understanding? I mean, so there has been, DACA has been restored there. Yeah. I imagine in the event that the Democrats control both houses, there's going to be an attempt to create the statutory authority for the DACA program. What have you heard in regards to DAPA, which is sort of an extension of DACA in some regards, the family of those children who have been brought to the country? Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of what's happening in that area.
Yeah, I mean, what we have, you know, heard many times now, not just by the president or the president-elect, and also our vice president-elect, you know, she has even been more outspoken about this, of sending a bill to Congress in the first day. And again, I think that is definitely a good thing. And also, we have to be very cautious, right, that we're not just taking one track. And by what I mean by that is that we don't know if we're going to have the Senate or if Democrats are going to have the Senate. You know, we still are waiting for Georgia to see what happens there. And what we have seen in the past is that it's been really, really challenging to get anything on immigration through Congress without Republicans asking for more deportations, asking for more detention centers, more enforcement, in the sense that, you know, they talk about enforcement in not in a humane way, but rather how do we incarcerate and deport the most people as we can. And so we want to make sure that, yes, there is an attempt and that they're fighting really hard to get something through Congress. And at the same time, as you mentioned, programs like DAPA, right, that were able to be done through the executive. And there's a lot more of that. TPS is one of the programs, as well as a temporary protective status that was also done through administrative action many years ago to be able to, allow for people from El Salvador and other countries to seek refuge here because of disasters that have happened in their countries, right? Well, we have one going on right now, and it's called COVID-19. So let's think about how do we make sure that we're also providing relief for people while we fight in Congress through administrative action and through everything that Biden can do. And the last thing I'll say is this: Trump showed us that he was completely in the opposite side of us, but he did everything he could through administrative action to make the lives of immigrants miserable. And so for us, you know, to ask Biden to at least take a look and be creative about what he can do to provide relief to the undocumented community in this country, and to also be able to welcome and find ways to welcome refugees and asylum seekers in a humane way, is incredibly important for us to do both, right? Congress, yes, and also everything we can do through the administrative.
So Trump, on some level, just led by example in terms of at least the authority that the president has in this area. Let me just ask you, as a DACA recipient, I mean, what and obviously there's a lot of work to be done. And I am, you know, very aware of the Obama administration. It was and the number of deportations that took place under there and their In some respects, pioneering some of the aspects of family separation. They didn't go nearly as far as the Trump administration, but they certainly sort of maybe planted some seeds or had some stuff floating out there. But what, just for a moment, like, talk about your reaction to Joe Biden winning, and at the very least, and I guess, you know, you could roll this into what the federal court did. I mean, you know, I know people who are not directly implicated by the Trump administration are like, you know, it feels like a breath of fresh air as I walk around. But I mean, this had material consequences for you.
Yes, absolutely. I'll be very honest. The day that I learned, you know, that Biden had won, as soon as I saw the news come up, I broke down in tears, and it was happy tears. It was just relief, you know, and these past almost 4 years have been so stressful for the immigrant community. And, you know, as an immigration activist, I mean, we haven't stopped. It was just day after day, week after week, it was something new. I mean, there were over 400 policies that he changed on immigration. You know, speaking of Trump, like, he changed over 400 policies on immigration on his own. And so, as you can imagine, I mean, it was day after day of changes. And to me, it was just such relief to know that perhaps, let me tell you, I don't think Biden is going to be our savior at all. I mean, I was an immigration activist under Obama, too, and I know that's not going to be the case. However, we have a very different opportunity, and we could not push Trump. We cannot, you know, go and try to push Trump to get what we needed, right? To get what we wanted, to change policies. But now we have an opportunity with Biden, and we're gonna work really hard to push him. But it's just such a different opportunity than we had with Donald Trump as a president.
What are the if you have a list of things as to and maybe even the sequence of what you're going to be pushing the Biden administration to do? What does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the priority is to undo all the harm from Trump. Obviously, that's, you know, again, there were so many policy changes that happened under Trump. I mean, there was
restore the temporary protected status, reestablish DACA, reestablish DAPA, I guess. Roll back some of the detention. What else?
Yeah. And also acknowledge that there was a mistake from the Obama administration on creating this deportation machine and this detention machine that now basically was handed over to Trump. Right. And so we do expect there's a dismantling of this machine. And that means a lot of things. And look, we have an entire platform that we created as Raices, another organization called the Migrant Justice Platform. It's huge because there's so many policies and immigration is so complicated. But what we want to make sure is that we are not falling into the same trap of thinking that in order for us to get something through Congress, that we have to, as I mentioned before, maybe I'm just repeating myself, that we shouldn't be putting people in detention centers. Immigration detention didn't exist not too long ago. ICE didn't exist not too long ago. And Border Patrol was much smaller years ago, right? And so there is a way to go back and also make things better when it comes to immigration enforcement. And that is viewed from a lens of knowing that immigrants are human beings. And so, you know, that can look like changing all the programs that were created for ICE and the police at the local level to work together. There's many of those programs. Majority of people get deported out of the police arresting them for a traffic stop, and then they get handed over to ICE. There is all the private detention center contracts that exist. Those should be gone on day one. There's no reason we are paying private companies to detain immigrants. And, you know, I can go on and on, but it's definitely something we're going to be pushing Biden on, and to change this narrative of, you know, we're deporting felons, not families, because that's not the reality. My own mother was detained by ICE during the Obama era. She didn't do anything wrong, yet she was labeled as a felon because she crossed the border in 1998. And so there's a lot that needs to change around that. And I have a lot of hope. You know, Alejandro Mayorkas has been someone who is better than some of the other DHS.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, yeah. I mean, I've heard, you know, I've read conflicting accounts as to his time in that agency. He is, of course, the nominated Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Give us your perspective on Mayorkas.
Yeah, I mean, listen, he was one of the people who worked on creating DACA. around the Obama era, you know, I was very involved in the Dreamer movement, and we were some of the people who started pushing Obama in 2011. And I can tell you that the rhetoric about around DACA around that time was completely different than now from Democrats in general, to be honest with you, and especially from the Obama administration, is that they couldn't do it. It was just no go. We can't do this. And at some point, you know, we pressured so much that we were able to sort of, you know, get some response from the Obama administration. And eventually they came around, right? And Alejandro Mayorkas was one of the people who, you know, really created the program, was, you know, creative and in how to create it so that it followed the law. And it's a lawful program, right? So that's great. And that gave me a lot of hope that he could find ways to provide relief to the undocumented community. Now, the part that I'm worried about is that he did use a lot of rhetoric in the past, you know, around this, what I mentioned before of we're deporting all the felons and we're keeping all right. the families together. And you know, who falls into that crack? It's a lot of people. There's millions of people. And let's just acknowledge, too, our criminal justice system is completely broken as well. And so if we're not acknowledging that, and we're not acknowledging that people, immigrants, are also getting, you know, either felonies, misdemeanors, and also being criminalized for literally migrating to the United States, then we're just, again, deporting and separating families. And we're covering that under this rhetoric, you know, that has been used for so many years under Obama.
In the most charitable perspective, what Obama was doing, and I'm going to concede and start off by saying this is pretty charitable, that he was trying to establish his bona fides as a you know, as being a hawk on immigration, and so that he could be positioned to make a deal with Republicans. It failed miserably, and if anything, it moved the needle, at least on the Republican side, to the right on immigration, obviously, and we've seen that. Do you think Democrats understood that? Do you think they walked away with a lesson of, like, you know what? There is no pretending or actually being an immigrant hawk as a way of getting some type of comprehensive immigration reform, but rather we just need to push forward and get as much as we can.
Yeah, I think some Democrats did, you know, and I'll be honest with you, I think some Democrats did. And, you know, there's now, I think there's a bigger part of the party who sees immigration in a different way because they saw what Trump was doing and how he used the Obama, you know, infrastructure to create all these just terrible policies. However, you know, I was just listening to Schumer, and I was listening to a few of the other, you know, Cornyn and other senators. Well, he's not a Democrat, obviously, but I was listening to them together, you know, in the same program on Zoom. I can't even remember what conference anymore. But one of the things that really just got me so frustrated was to hear Senator Schumer once again come back to the same rhetoric from, I mean, it was like deja vu. I was like,
right.
Oh my God, we're in the Obama era again. And I am really afraid that, you know, people like him, or I hope, you know, Nancy Pelosi has learned some of those lessons, and that they don't begin with a compromise. Why don't we start fighting with everything that we want to do? And down the line, you know, we're going to get to a point where we're going to know what they want. And I mean, we know what they want, but if there needs to be a compromise, we're going to know what that's going to be. But unfortunately, on immigration, Democrats have always started with a compromise. And here we're going to deport millions of people. We're going to create terrible conditions in detention centers and at the border. And we want 11 million people to become citizens. And that's just not a good way to start this conversation.
Yeah, I hope hope springs eternal, but I am somewhat skeptical that they have been able to develop a different approach, frankly. But I guess we'll see. I mean, let's just briefly talk from an electoral perspective. How large does immigration loom? I mean, I feel like it looms pretty large on the right in terms of Republican circles, and not in a very humane way. But how large does this does immigration loom, do you feel? And I think, you know, with the general population that would vote, let's say, for a Democrat, And also to the extent, and obviously the Latino population is not a a monolith. But across all of the, you know, your sense of where immigration stands within all of those potential voting cohorts.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's just very challenging for the immigrant community to have the type of political power that we need to push our issue forward, because we can't vote. The majority of us can't vote. I can't vote. I've been really outspoken and I've used my voice, but I'm not able to go into the ballot and tell them, like, this is what our community needs, right? And so that is a really big challenge. Now, I can tell you, someone who grew up in Arizona, you know, as someone who has been really involved in Arizona politics for many years, is that Arizona was one of those places where you did see Latinos come out to vote in record numbers. You did see Latinos come out to vote before even 2020 to unseat Joe Arpaio, who was one of the worst, most anti-immigrant sheriffs that we have had, you know, and he's just famous for being an anti-immigrant. And, you know, in 2020, we saw what we were able to do in Arizona. We turned the state around, and that took more than 10 years of immigrant rights activists and Latino activists, you know, Native American activists, and a lot of other people of color who were coming out and organizing the community and also resisting against a lot of this anti-immigrant laws that Arizona had passed in 2010 and before. And now we saw what happened with the state. Of course, we're not Florida. There's a different population of Latinos in Arizona, but immigration here was a very, very important issue to the Latino community. And so one thing we can learn from these elections, I hope, is that, yes, perhaps, you know, the Latino community and other communities are coming out to vote because of healthcare, because of things that are right in front of them, right? If they're not immigrants. However, if you start attacking the immigrant community, if you pass laws like SB 1070 in Arizona and start racially profiling the Latino community, I honestly think that there has been enough proof that you can lose your seat, and that you can turn some of these states around, like Arizona and now Georgia. You know, it's another state that has passed really, really terrible anti-immigrant laws. And we also have saw the immigrant community come out really strong there. I mean, I'm sorry, the Latino community.
Yeah. And I think it also just basically teaches that, you know, you build an infrastructure in a state that has been organized around whatever issue it is. That organizational structure can be deployed for other issues and grows upon itself. Erica Andiola, the chief advocacy officer for races in Texas. Folks can check out races at races.org. Is that it?
Yeah, it's at racestexas.org. Okay. So you can just add the Texas and also check us out on social media. Definitely. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today. Really appreciate it. We are back. Emma, that just saw a story in the Washington Post that came out today that there is an increase in shoplifting of food in this country. Last year, this year, we have 54 million Americans who are estimated to have suffered hunger this year. That's a 45% increase from last year. And today in the Senate talks, Mitch McConnell just being reported that the bipartisan bill, this is the Gang of Four, the $908 billion compromise, no go in the Senate, as far as Mitch McConnell is concerned.
1.4 million Americans filed for unemployment last week. So 19 million in total over that number.
Exactly. And we have 12 million who are going to be off the extended unemployment as of December 26th. We have the eviction moratorium that's going to happen around the country. And, you know, on some level, this is completely, obviously, there is no doubt about it. Mitch McConnell is the obstacle here to get any type of relief. But, and I may be cynical, I can't help but think that the Democrats had the opportunity to take a $1.8 trillion deal. Maybe they didn't want Donald Trump to take credit for that. It's a political calculation, but one that has, but the other calculation that one could make is that Mitch McConnell has no incentive whatsoever to provide anything for the American public. Part of that is because he's able to get away with it. But this is something that we will talk about more tomorrow. We have a 1 week punt on the budget deal that the Democrats and Republicans are trying to work out. We will have more on that tomorrow as well. In the meantime, if you're sticking around for the fun half, the crew will be here in a moment. I want to take this opportunity to, because I'm not going to be here in the fun half today, to wish one of, to be honest with you, I'm not even sure I know the person's name, but they are known as Letter Hack on Twitter.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And for, I have no sense of time, but at least what feels like a year, maybe more, probably more. I have no idea. He has been making animated illustrations of things that he's heard on the show almost like in real time. There's Brendan's and there's Matt. On his birthday, he asked folks, it really is amazing.
He's so good.
We've got to get in touch and maybe put out a book or something. But
he did some of me at TYT with, that crew, but I feel like I need, some updates with the background and stuff like that.
Well, for his birthday, he asked people to draw versions of all of us and other folks in the progressive media space. So it's pretty cool. You should check out his Twitter feed. But there was talk that he wanted to hear Shofar for his birthday. And there it is. He's got a podcaster as well. And he turned, I don't know if he turned 50 or 46. I couldn't quite tell. But there it is. Letter Hack, happy birthday. Thanks for all the work you're doing. Folks, today on The Nomi Key Show on youtube.com/The Nomi Key Show, Marianne Williamson is going to be on. I think I sort of teased that yesterday, but she's going to be on today. Check that out at 3 p.m. Guys, remind everybody to check out Nomi's show then. And also a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member. Join themajorityreport.com. When you do, you get you support the free half. And then you get extra content every single day. Of course, also just coffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, don't forget, we have merch. It's time for you to get your holiday presents. Got to do it quick. Shop.majorityreportradio.com. Check it out. It's all there. And on the fun half today, the host of Doomed, Matt Binder. What's happening on Doomed these days?
Well, just last night we had an emergency episode of Doomed because Alex Koch of the Center for Media and Democracy answered the age-old question people have been wondering for at least a few years now: who funds the Federalist? Apparently, the Federalist started a nonprofit for their donors to get their tax breaks from when actually donating to them, and didn't realize that that information would be made public. And now we know some of their big money donors. Now, I can't tell you on this show because you have to go to youtube.com.
I'm sorry, I already read it. I saw. It's that U-line guy.
What are you doing to me? No. But
there's more. There's more. There's more.
There is more.
Folks, check it out. You got to write that stuff up.
Yeah. Well, there's actually another organization that donated to big donations.
Don't say what it is.
I won't, but they've donated to also a very prominent white supremacist group to buy them a castle.
So I'm sure that's a coincidence.
Yeah.
If I had a nickel for every castle I've bought for a white supremacist organization, oh my gosh. I mean, I don't know how that works out. If I had a nickel for everybody, I'd have less money because the castles are more expensive.
Right. Well, I get what you're saying, though, Sam. It makes sense to me.
Yeah. Folks, check out that emergency episode of Doomed. I don't know if emergency is the right one. The breaking emergency. Episode.
Okay. I mean, he wasn't supposed to be on the show. I wasn't even supposed to do a show yesterday, and I saw the report, and I reached out to him. I was like, we got to do this.
Emergency.
Emergency. But now you could still ask, though, who else funds the Federalist, because that's not everybody. There's still some mysterious benefactors out there that have yet to be uncovered.
Well, and it was fun to say, like, who funds you every time they post something really egregiously stupid. But now you can say, hey, Uline funds you, and you're a bootlicker for him. And it's kind of funny, like, when the Turning Point is funded by, like, fracking guys in Texas. Like, just to know that anytime they cover those topics.
Indeed.
Right. I mean, you could still say who else funds the Federalist. Right. I'm sure they'll still get bothered by that as well.
Jamie, did you have an emergency episode of the Antifada this week, or...
Every episode is kind of an emergency, right? Like,
hell yeah.
The people need their podcast. We need it right now. Yeah. So this week on the Antifada, Sean and I vibed on some news. Uber got owned. They basically admitted that self-driving cars are nowhere happening no time soon, which is what they bet their whole business model on. We talked about the politics around the COVID vaccine. We talked about how real estate tycoons are making record profits in the pandemic, and a little happy news about Amazon workers organizing. So that's out now, patreon.com/theantifada. Also, last night we did our inaugural Wednesday night Twitch stream show. It's in soft launch mode, but you can soft watch launch. It. Yeah.
What game you guys play?
Oh, we did the greatest game of all, politics. I'm not much of a gamer, but Sean is going, he's just bought himself like a ridiculous gaming desktop with like neon lights inside, and he will be gaming sometimes on the Twitch. But no, we just talked about politics in the news, as is our wont, and we had on Tony Boswell from the very funny podcast Minion Death Cult to talk about his experience recently with getting soft fired from his job after having to isolate responsibly because he was exposed to COVID, just found out that the boss stopped putting him on the schedule.
Oh, and great.
Like,
yeah, that's going to be healthy for everybody.
When were you going to tell me? And it was, it was awful. So we talked a lot about that. We made some communization theory jokes, which I was very proud that our listeners understood. They've clearly been paying attention. We had a lot of fun, and that's, I think Twitch leaves it up for like a week, maybe. So you can still catch that if you missed it at twitch.tv/theantifada, or it's going to be out Friday, in premium form, because we'll cut off the half hour at the beginning when Sean and I were trying to figure out how to use the computer. That's going to be out Friday.
Maybe you should release that. You release that one too, just in case, the half an hour. That could be, that can be fun too.
Yeah, you don't know what people are going to like.
New Matt, what's happening with the cavalcade of shows that you're involved with?
Well, we'll just focus on Left Reckoning tonight at 7 p.m. on the YouTube channel for Left Reckoning. We're going to be doing our own sort of soft launch show. It's going to be on Thursday nights at 7. First up, Tyson Plant. We're going to be talking about the betting pool, about how many pork plant employees are going to catch COVID. Talk about Uruguay, Argentina, and India. Also, Facebook antitrust and some COVID stuff as well. So check that out tonight at 7 at the Left Reckoning YouTube page.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you.
The
you're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America. You. Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.